Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Was never said to be all that pretty, or that smart, or that educated, or that funny, or, to be honest, all that virtuous. She wasn't a lot of the things you might expect from a woman who literally made a king wait for her favors for 6 years. But she was something. No one really knows how she did it, but she withstood the King of England's relentless sexual advances before selecting the exact right time to give in. She had patience because she wanted to be queen, not just some easy mistress who could be used up and tossed aside by the man. She had seen that firsthand. It happened to her sister Mary, who it is said even bore the king a son, but not a legitimate one. Not the heir kind. No, Anne was holding out to be the wife of a king and, in short order, a mother to a king. And that would have to wait, because the king could not somehow get adequately divorced. And he was a king, damn it. What was the holdup? The holdup was Catherine, the king's wife, the Spanish-born Queen of England, the mother of his only living heir, Mary, who had been raised Catholic, as Catherine was. And despite every imaginable attempt by every imaginable official dragging out every imaginable argument, the Pope, the king's only recourse, was stalling. Even the dents among us could see the Pope's point. Catherine and Henry had been married for 24 years. She had endured multiple pregnancies, as well as the unimaginable heartbreak that only 2 children were born alive, and only 1 lived to adulthood. It all pointed to a very well-consummated marriage. Yeah, annulment seems a hard sell here. Let me interrupt my foray into medieval religion and royal lust for a brief moment, to save myself a lot of explaining later. The crime I'm about to talk of is filled with all kinds of delicious backstory and even better afterstory. It's a crime that changed almost everything we know today. Even for those of us who don't live on the British Isles, for those of us who are Catholic, and for the rest of us who believe whatever we do. It really is a crime of the 16th century that bleeds profusely into every other century after it. I'm gonna call it the crime of the centuries. See what I did there? But it's also so freaking complicated that I'm going to beg any Renaissance scholars to give me a break. Don't write, don't call, don't text, don't comment as I gloss quickly and, perhaps unevenly, over the history of an entire continent as it existed during the late 1400s and then into the 16th century. Because squishing this much European chaos into 45 minutes was no picnic for me. I'm just kidding, it was actually kind of great because now I know a lot about something I used to only know a little about. It will make seeing Six on Broadway that much more entertaining, and maybe it'll help me win at Jeopardy. I'll take medieval hanky-panky for 600. So yeah, this monstrous crime starts with the crime of bigamy. But because this particular instance of bigamy happens when it does and with the people involved, a multitude of other way worse crimes attach to it, like murder, torture, bribery, theft, conspiracy, excessive royal ass-kissing, and an appalling lack of common sense. I could go on. You name it, the people we're going to talk about today are guilty of all this and more many, many times over. Still, I want to stress that this story belongs to the victim of the crime, Catherine of Aragon, the first wife of Henry VIII, an extraordinary woman who had faith enough for a dozen men and fortitude enough for an army of them. She's not all that well known to most. She's the subject of a whole episode of something called Forgotten History, for heaven's sake. I mean, people know of her and that she was one of Henry VIII's six wives, but not many people really know her story. Pop culture has tended to fixate on that sexy lynx Anne Boleyn, even though, for my money, Catherine is the most remarkable one of Henry's six wives because her decisions to mark, or so real historians tell me, one epoch of world history from the next. That, while also stopping two wars, raising a queen, defying a king, and tearing asunder the most powerful church on earth. In my book, that's some pretty nice revenge. Catherine was born in 1485, the youngest daughter of Ferdinand II and Isabella, the king and queen of different provinces of Spain who united the country in marriage. That meant that Catherine grew up understanding that her mother was a queen in her own right, and that women could wield a lot of power. And yes, her parents were the ones who handed some cash to Christopher Columbus so he could invade a different continent and ruin a lot of Native American lives while inviting everyone else to come join him in the conquest. I digressed. Crime, you know? It's everywhere you look. Anyway. From Catherine's earliest memory, she was referred to by her family as the Princess of Wales. That's because she was betrothed at the age of 3 to the heir to the English throne because Spain needed a strong alliance with England, and England needed the Spanish for their own reasons. A marriage would seal that goodwill into solid stone. Meanwhile, the Prince of Wales was only 2. His name was Arthur. His father, King Henry VII, rather dubiously claimed a direct lineage back to the Arthur you know. The one who had the round table and all those glorious 12th century knights. In fact, the Tudor's claim to the throne of England was rather iffy. And when number 7 was crowned, the country wasn't the biggest prize, having little money and having recently lost possession of land on the continent of Europe. But Henry VII made good and was, when searching for a wife for his firstborn, looking for some seriously royal bloodlines to shore up his shaky one. Hence, it was a coup to grab this Spanish daughter who came with her own extra blue bloodline, her mother's to Castilian royalty, for good measure. Royal blood beats usurper blood every time. Catherine was 15 when she sailed to her new home to meet the man she was to marry. Hopes were high because Henry VII knew this marriage would mean he had finally made it into the pantheon of respectability. That is, that the kings of Europe would have signaled to him that they accepted his monarchy as legitimate and worthy, thus solidifying his and his country's power and securing immense trade opportunities for the island nation. Catherine also conveniently had a link to the English throne through her mother's Lancastrian blood. It also meant that she was Henry's third cousin, which bothered absolutely no one back then. Nobody knew what to expect when Catherine stepped onto British soil. To everyone's delight, she was a mature and self-contained woman, a strawberry blonde with a small frame and well-bred manner. Some would call her beautiful. But everyone's beautiful at 15. They just are. From history's forgotten people,
Little is known of the first impressions the young couple had of each other, but Arthur wrote to his parents that he would be a true and loving husband, and that he was happy to behold the face of his lovely bride.
Her fiancé, blonde and slight, then a shade shorter than she, was 14. They had been writing to one another for years, in Latin no less, in anticipation of this day. When she was introduced all around, she also met Henry, Arthur's younger brother, who was 10. The wedding, suffused with splendor and pomp, was costly. The expense fell on the city of London because the skinflint that was the English king couldn't quite loosen his purse strings for all that obligatory celebration. The young Henry, then the preteen Duke of York, escorted her down the aisle. The dowry Catherine's father was to pay to Henry VII was causing much consternation in the meantime. Said to be worth either 200,000 crowns or 200,000 escudos, partly paid in jewelry and plate, it was not paid in full, or so said the English king, when the youngsters tied the knot. But he trusted the Spanish monarchy to make good, so the wedding went off without a hitch. By the way, I tried to convert 200,000 crowns to American dollars and got schooled that a crown is now a Bitcoin kind of thing, and, well, never mind. An escudo was the monetary unit of Portugal until the euro came along, and I can't do that calculation either. And no, I don't know what a plate is, but biographers have included little hints. It's said that if Catherine could be tricked into wearing the jewelry or eating off the plates, then Ferdinand and Isabella would be embarrassed to use them as payment. So I guess we're talking about a real plate. Got it. It was probably gold, but I'm just spitballing there. On to the wedding night.
But unlike so many royal weddings before, including that of her own parents, there was no display of blood-soaked sheets the following morning. It may seem grotesque to us now, but such a display was proof of a healthy young couple who would create heirs for the kingdom and therefore stability.
The dowry issue was still being ironed out. Spoiler alert, it never would be. As the future king and queen of England were whisked away to Wales to live in a damp but exceedingly large castle. Two kids destined for greatness off to oversee things for his father. This is where, 4 months later, Arthur died of the very vague disease called consumption. Or maybe it was sweating sickness, a rat-borne virus, or influenza. No matter, on April 2nd, 1502, Arthur was history. Catherine would later swear that while they had laid down together 7 times, not once had they had intercourse, thus her marriage to him had been unconsummated. One doctor contradicted her, but Catherine and her entire retinue of ladies-in-waiting swore that she was still a virgin. They should know. Arthur, if he ever had a say in the matter, apparently did joke to his buds on the second day of his marriage that last night he had been in the midst of Spain. But a lot of people chalk that up to his need to brag about what happened in the back seat of his car. The doctor, for his part, apologized for his mistake, but letters flew between both houses of royalty, between English clergy, Spanish ambassadors, officials of both countries, and every gossip in Europe about what the kids had been up to, or hadn't been up to. The truth behind this small point was to have huge consequences and would be debated for 400 years. Now everyone rushed around with what to do with Princess Catherine, who assured everyone she would not be producing an heir anytime soon because, well, you know. From an episode of The People Profiles.
News was quickly sent concerning Arthur's demise to London, and from there, dispatches were sent by King Henry's government to Spain to inform Catherine's parents that their daughter was already a widow, and these same dispatches were quickly responded to Would it be possible, Isabella and Ferdinand wondered, for Catherine to now marry Henry's second son, also named Henry after his father? The boy was only just about to turn 12 years of age. But if they waited a few years, he and Catherine could wed, and the Anglo-Spanish alliance could be continued.
This idea got some attention, but Henry VII wanted to wait to see how the current war across the channel was going. He didn't wish to tie his heir to a loser's daughter. He and Elizabeth, his wife, responded vaguely. The dowry that England said had not been paid meant that
she was unable to claim her dower, a third of her late husband's properties and lands, and was instead given £1,200 a year as an allowance from the English crown.
Then, on February 11, 1503, her mother-in-law Elizabeth died in childbirth and was barely in the ground when Catherine was offered up to wed number 7, the grieving widower and aging monarch whose continuing lineage depended solely on Henry, the kiddo who seemed to be in robust health, but you never know. Queen Isabella, Catherine's mother, pooh-poohed that idea. Her young daughter would have been destined to a life of a too early sheltered widowhood. Henry VII did not persist. Thank goodness. He was about 50 years old at this point. Catherine was 17. I know this was more common back then, but still. Gross. Behind the scenes, Henry still needed his Spanish alliance, which was tied very closely to the Holy Roman Empire. The Emperor Charles was Catherine's nephew, and everybody wanted to be all tied up with alliances now because France was acting up. As you may have surmised, the idea that the pretty and smart Princess of Wales could wed number 8 gathered some steam. But there was a problem with that. As Garrett Mattingly wrote in his scholarly book, Catherine of Aragon, quote, "Because Catherine had previously contracted a good and valid marriage with Arthur, and thus become related to Henry, his brother, in the first degree of affinity, a canonical impediment to marriage which only a papal dispensation could remove, the contracting parties bound themselves to use all their influence at Rome to obtain the necessary bulls," end quote. Bulls are, and I'm quoting Google now, papal briefs used by the Catholic Church to communicate various decisions, proclamations, and decrees. It comes from the Latin word bulla, to boil. And it also comes with a round seal, usually made of lead, with a pontifical emblem attached to it by a ribbon. In other words, God, speaking through, in this case, the Pope, had to say it was okay to marry your brother's wife, even though God had said it was not okay in Leviticus chapter 18, verse 1. In fact, the whole chapter covers a range of who a man can't have sex with, and I'm quoting here too, but not in ancient Hebrew. Your father's wives, your sister or half-sister or stepsister, your father's sister, your mother's sister, your daughter-in-law, or your brother's wife. Of course, the Bible can be confusing. In Deuteronomy 25, God says a man has to marry his dead brother's wife to fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law. But, not to belabor this, it was Leviticus that was imperiling Catherine and Henry's happily ever after. Because Henry was 13, they had time for the Pope to think about it. Meanwhile, Catherine couldn't remarry, and she refused to go back to Spain. So she sat in England, living completely at the whim of her tightwad father-in-law, to whom she looked for an allowance. He gave her very little, hardly enough to feed herself and the 50 in her household. I'm not being facetious, the whole household was in rags and starving. Mattingly found, though, that the princess, while waiting, helped herself to some education. Quote, "She saw Henry as often as she could. She collected every scrap she could of political gossip and learned slowly to weigh men and events, to understand in part the seamy side of court intrigues and the complications of European diplomacy. She learned, too, this was a hard lesson to keep her head and her temper, to be patient, wary, close-mouthed, to endure it without assigned insult, humiliation, open rebuffs and sly persecutions, to be spied on and lied to and browbeaten without betraying herself, without abandoning for an instant her sense of the larger issue, her relentless pursuit of her one aim, end quote. That one aim? Be her father's voice in the room, to be Spain's voice in the room, while keeping the two countries she was tied to friendly and cooperative in all things. The men around her were now deeply engaged in what I can only call anti-diplomacy. The Pope wasn't budging. The heads of state in other countries were pushing for other brides for Henry and other marriages across the whole of Europe. Any and all of these unions could create vast imbalances in European power, so every monarch, ambassador, duke, earl, member of clergy, and the dustbin boy was forced to throw around accusations of who said what to whom, and which contracts had loopholes, and which were ironclad, and who was on first base. I kid, but really, for Catherine, it was a time of unrest and penury. She was shunned by those in the English court and said to be lonely. She had to take up piecework to make ends meet. She pawned some of her good silver. Henry's 15th birthday, her alleged wedding day, came and went without a vow being exchanged. Then some talk at the court was gelling over the fact that the whole English-Spanish wedding idea was doomed. Catherine wasn't having it. She would not leave England. She had been sent there to form an alliance, and by God, she wasn't leaving until she formed it. In 1505, the Pope gave dispensation for Catherine and Henry to wed. More official waiting ensued, but Henry and Catherine, who had been moved to live at the king's court because it was cheaper than keeping her in a castle somewhere else, got to liking each other's company. Dowry negotiations got weird again. Then, in April 1509, the 52-year-old Henry VII died. The very next day, the new king pretty much declared himself the new sheriff in town. He went to the Tower of London and, quoting Mattingly again, freed prisoners, arrested the most unpopular of his father's officials, proclaimed a general pardon, and ordered those who had been injured by the crown should hasten to inform his council, all amidst the great popular rejoicing. Now everyone could eat what they wanted, buy what they wanted, have music and jousting and feasting, without fear that the king's men would arrest them for doing so. The 17-year-old was also ready to spend some money, and just as soon as his father was buried, he announced that
one of his father's dying wishes had been for the marriage to proceed.
They were wed in a rather quiet ceremony on June 11, 1509. She was 23, and he was about to turn 18. When he was invested as king after an appropriate period of mourning for his father, she would be by his side as his wife and as queen. Henry VIII and his new bride Catherine were not the couple most of us think of, should we ever think of them. She was not dumpy and charmless. He was not massive, gout-ridden, and overly ready to chop off heads. He was big, yes, but he had an athlete's build, had a teenager's loose-limbed grace, and had had enough of being bored and restrained and told what to do. She was young as well, game for whatever her marriage brought her. mature, grounded. But if her young husband wanted tournaments and games and mass balls, show her where to sign up. They were devoted to one another, truly. It was often his ministers heard him say how much the queen would enjoy this bit of gossip or that joke. They enjoyed their money and their obligations. Both loved books, both loved flying hawks, both loved learning how to rule. He often took tips about things she knew her father had done. She was her father's tacit ambassador with a direct line to the King of England. They trusted each other. It was grand. Then her first child, a girl, was prematurely delivered stillborn. It is said he took it harder than she. He knew he wanted / needed an heir to continue the dynasty the Tudors deserved. The next pregnancy did that. A boy, born healthy, was welcomed with the kind of merrymaking that those in England were getting used to. A grand tournament was planned, and nobles flocked to London to participate in the games and rejoicing. Instead, they were on hand for the funeral of the male child named Henry, who lived for only 52 days. Catherine retreated to pray for intercession. Her husband grieved alone, so afraid were others to even offer condolences. They moved on. Henry's eye wandered a bit, but that was to be expected of royalty, if you were a king, not a queen. By the standards of the day, though, wrote Mattingly, Henry was an unusually faithful husband. He had their initials inked and sewn onto everything in sight. Apparently, he was also his own decorator. Then he decided, as English kings do, to invade France and figured war would be a great time to show his people that he wasn't just a fun king, he was a warrior too. And Catherine was left in charge on the home front.
In June 1513, Henry launched his own campaign to France, which he led in person, across the English Channel to land in the north of the country. In his absence, Catherine served as governor of the realm and captain general of England during the late summer and autumn of 1513. It was a critical period. On the 22nd of August, King James IV of Scotland, who was acting in defense of Scotland's traditional ally, the French, invaded northern England. A large English army was quickly gathered, much of the logistical work being carried out by Catherine and the government's senior ministers.
She was also pregnant at the time, but she didn't let that stop her. She sat at the head of the king's council, gave orders to her noblemen about how to conduct the war, directed her ladies to make bandages and banners, and sent instructions to France about how to make sure Henry didn't catch cold. You think I'm kidding? I'm not. Then the English beat back the Scots, and Catherine sent James IV's bloodied coat to France to show her husband what she had done. Then Catherine's newborn son was born and died shortly after. Another stillborn son followed in 1515. In 1516, when she was 31, she delivered a healthy girl, Mary, who would be the only one of her children to live into adulthood. Later, that girl would reign briefly as Queen of England, but that ended badly when she tried to revert the English back to Catholicism. Her love for her people was so strong that she was nicknamed Bloody Mary for burning 280 of them at the stake for being heretics, or as we know them, Protestants. Back to Catherine, who rapidly got pregnant again, and another daughter arrived, but died shortly thereafter. It's during this period that the king was getting more certain of his own greatness and less concerned about the cruelty he would inflict on so many that voiced any opinion against him. Mary was just a small child when sexual relations between her parents apparently ceased, and things began a rapid downhill slide. Catherine was said to be less vigorous and, according to the scribes of the times, increasingly less alluring. You'd be less alluring too if you were constantly pregnant and the children you carried died before you barely had time to hold them. As a result, she spent more time in devotion, more time with her charities, most specifically, care for the poor. And as Mary grew up, the Queen turned her attention to what sort of education her daughter needed if she was to be the heir and, in the process, set an example for the education of women that profited many others of their class, including, I might add, the future Queen of England, Elizabeth I. She was a prodigious patron of scholarship, especially in the halls of Oxford and Cambridge. She was doing the job of being an exemplary English queen, though she still confessed regularly to a priest in her native tongue. Now I'm going to explain what happened next in as concise a manner as I can, but again, if I've done too much condensing, blame these people who were so busy up in each other's business to make history almost indecipherable. Okay, here goes. When Mary was 9, she was betrothed to the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. You remember, his name was Charles, and Catherine was his aunt. Oh, and he was 24 years old. He said he preferred to marry someone his age. His eye was on a comely princess in Portugal, also a cousin. This angered Dad Henry, who sent young Mary to Wales to become the acting Princess of Wales, and also convinced him he could not trust any other European monarch to hold up their ends of bargains. The king's chief sycophant, Cardinal Wolsey, was in the thick of this, and Catherine was now without her daughter and, because things were getting really unglued, one of her ladies-in-waiting had given birth to a son who was clearly the king's child, and it looked like Mary was going to get screwed over in the inheritance department because Henry might name the now 6-year-old lad as the rightful heir. I mean, if there was any question that this kid was the king's son, that was dispelled by the boy's name. It was Henry Fitzroy, that last name literally meaning son of the king. Catherine was mad. Henry didn't care. You don't have to be Dr. Phil to see the handwriting on this wall. Then, in 1524, amid his chasing Anne Boleyn around the castle to no avail, something dawned on him. In the BBC series, The Six Wives of Henry VIII, this is likely how he opened this conversation with Catherine.
Catherine, I am greatly troubled in my mind.
What is it? Can I help?
Yes, 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 you always help me. Catherine, someone has shown me, I have seen, there is a text in Leviticus.
Which,
yes, chapter 20, there, verse 21. And if a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing, they shall be childless. Learned and pious men have told me that because you were first married to my brother, our marriage is unlawful in the sight of God. You and I, we are living in sin together, and that is why we have no son.
We need an annulment, he said. You know, that dissolution of marriage that straight up erases the marriage's existence so you can say you were never married. You might be wondering how Henry could reach that conclusion, considering he and Catherine had been married since 1509. And had multiple children together, no matter how sad most of those pregnancies turned out. Well, in Henry's mind, it was because Catherine had been married to his brother first, and the Bible says don't marry your dead brother's wife, except that one part where it says to do exactly that, and that because she'd been married to Arthur and probably had slept with him, though she insisted she hadn't, God hadn't blessed their nuptials. Except that he had by way of the Pope, which gave them permission to marry. Long story short, Catherine wasn't buying what Henry was selling. Nope, she said, we're married, we've been married, we're staying married. This was a problem. By 1526, Henry was looking for a yes from Anne Boleyn.
In 1526, Henry began a new affair with Anne Boleyn, Mary's younger sibling, and this time Henry was more committed to his new mistress, and by 1527 he was determined that he would obtain a divorce from Catherine in order to marry again and hopefully produce a legitimate male heir. What was to become known as the King's Great Matter, his goal of achieving a divorce from his wife of nearly 20 years, would eventually turn every aspect of English political, social, and religious life upside down.
This Great Matter phrase wasn't one of those coined after the fact, by the way. People close to the king would walk around chatting about his Great Matter, and other people would nod because they knew what that meant. Oh yes, the Great Matter, the king's all-consuming desire to get divorced so he could marry Anne Boleyn. This was the 16th century equivalent of Page Six material. Now Henry's first instinct was to ask Pope Clement to clear the path. He figured he'd gotten one pope to approve the marriage, he could get another to null it.
Effectively, this was a request from the King of England, whose scruples were now severely affecting his judgment, that the Pope would sanction him to commit bigamy and have two queens at once.
Then Catherine announced she had a copy of the original dispensation and that the Pope at the time didn't care if she had or had not had sex with Arthur, God rest his soul. But to be clear, she said she had not. She was told outright that her reluctance to annul her marriage would lead to rack and ruin.
Madam, you must understand that these matters can lead to many and great evils. To enmity between the king and the emperor, to divisions within the English church, to scandal throughout Christendom.
The people of England chose the queen in this dogfight. So did quite a few of the king's ministers. This meant, said the king, that if she would decide now to go about presenting herself publicly, that was, in effect, inciting rebellion against him. So she could not leave where he had stashed her, and no one, especially her daughter, could visit. He did have an olive branch to extend. He suggested if she would become a nun, he would grant their daughter the right of succession. That did not go over well.
I have no calling to the religious life. While my husband lives, I am his wife, his own true wife. If it were not so, I would have been his whore and my daughter a bastard, and that I will never say.
Things got nastier still.
And when Henry decided he wanted to end his marriage to Catherine several years later, he would be impeded by her nephew, the most powerful ruler Europe had seen for several centuries.
This was getting dicey. In 1529, Catherine asked for an ecclesiastical trial in front of the Pope. The trial, said Henry, would be in England sans Pope. She agreed to appear. When the time came, she entered, said she believed her marriage was now, as it had always been, legitimate. At one point, history records that she knelt in front of the king and said he knew and she knew that she was his lawful wife. Then she left the court. Now, without the plaintiff present, Wolsey, who was in charge, said he was forced to adjourn the whole mess. Then Henry was summoned to Rome. How badly did that go over? Well, it led directly to Wolsey's death. But there were plenty of men more than willing to do the king's bidding. In 1529, the Reformation Parliament passed laws abolishing papal authority in England. Henry offered Catherine the title Princess Dowager, a title she never responded to because she was the Queen of England. There had to be another way. Find one, Henry demanded of his legions of advisors. In 1530, those legions, many of them scholars, traveled throughout Europe researching all of canon law, all biblical scholarship, and ancient texts that informed the words in Leviticus. The king paid well if the scholars came down on his side. It had the effect of lengthening the already long game of making Catherine more and more uncomfortable in her surroundings, removing much of the staff she leaned on for support and granting only one or two visits from their daughter. She was told, again, if she would just subject herself to his wishes, she and Mary could live anywhere they wanted in relative luxury. Blackmail? Most certainly. Was she in? Most certainly not. In January 1533, with Anne Boleyn now pregnant, the couple wed. His marriage to Catherine was not annulled until May 1533. Catherine be damned. A few men, notably English Chancellor Thomas More and Sir John Fisher, were beheaded because of their refusal to accept the king as head of the church. Even Cardinal Wolsey died on his way to the Tower of London, his fate sealed when he chose to send any trial on the matter back to Rome. Henry, rejecting of any authority that the Pope and the Catholic Church might try to exercise against him, passed the Act of Succession and then the Act of Supremacy and created the Church of England in 1534. Henry became its supreme head. This was happening just as the teachings of Martin Luther were making much headway in Europe, only a few years after he railed against his own church for its selling of indulgences in order to get into heaven. Some historians believe that the threat of Luther coming to England, or maybe simply his courage in breaking with the Catholic Church, prompted the king to lean into Protestantism. But most credit Catherine for making it happen as early as it did, and with the kind of upheaval that it caused throughout the kingdom. Catherine had left her native Spain when she was 15. She never saw it again. Mary was allowed to visit her mother briefly in 1534. For fear that the two would plot against him, the king made sure Catherine never saw her again. That same year, Pope Gregory XIV finally ruled on the issue of Catherine and Henry's marriage annulment. It could not be, the Pope decided. They were married in the eyes of God and would be for always. There was fear now that Catherine would gather troops and go to war with Henry over this. Even Henry knew she would have the powerful Emperor Charles on her side, but she would not go that far. She did ask the Pope to excommunicate Henry publicly, but take up arms? He had the wrong girl. She had never wished him harm. And maybe that's something Henry knew. He famously told several ministers later in life that,
"If I were to marry again, if the marriage might be good, I would surely choose her above all other women."
She died on January 7th, 1536. She was just 50. There are rumors that she had been poisoned, but historians have mostly discounted that. Cancer is the usual explanation. Four months later, Anne Boleyn was beheaded for high treason against the king. Among the charges, adultery, incest for supposedly sleeping with her brother George, and plotting to kill the king, though historians generally view the allegations with side eye. By the time of Anne's beheading, the king had received a letter that Catherine had written on her deathbed. It simply asked that her household be taken care of properly, that God might forgive both of them, and that, quote, "I make this vow that mine eyes desire you above all else," end quote. The scorned woman, it seems, never meant to inflict hell upon him. His crime, on the other hand, changed all that came after. But first, his subsequent marriages. You'll remember Catherine birthed Mary and Anne birthed Elizabeth. Neither offspring thrilled the king because of their vaginas. After Catherine's natural death and Anne's unnatural one, Henry married Jane Seymour, who gave birth to the only legitimate son he'd ever know. That son was Edward, and soon after his birth, Jane Seymour, who had never been coronated as queen, died, presumably from childbirth complications. Anne of Cleves was Henry's next wife, whom he picked from a pair of paintings of sisters, as in he wanted to marry one of the sisters of the German Duke of Cleves for alliance purposes. He found Anne's painting the more flattering of the two, chose her, and then balked because she didn't look like the painting. In short, this was the 16th century version of catfishing. They never consummated the marriage. Anne accepted a divorce and a generous settlement and lived comfortably until she died in 1557. Wife number five was Catherine Howard, a lady-in-waiting to Anne of Cleves. She was just a teenager. Within a year of their 1540 marriage, rumors surfaced that she'd been unfaithful, and so Henry executed her for adultery. Remember, it's fine for kings to sleep around, not for queens. Then finally, there was Catherine Parr, who sounds like she was an all-around decent person, though I hesitate to say that with much authority because she did marry into a house of nutbags. Regardless, she was said to have been a loving stepmother to Mary, Elizabeth, and Edward. She stayed by Henry's side until his death in 1547, and then she died a year after that. Then Edward became a boy king, and as we all know, it was smooth sailing in England after that. Kidding, but that's for another episode. As for Catherine of Aragon, historians are convinced that she and her staunch stand against the annulment of her marriage was the dividing point in history between when European monarchs were gaining power and when they began to lose it. That her hard line on the legality of her marriage was made when the Catholic Church was at its most powerful, her stubbornness was a very real cause of its subsequent decline, especially in Europe. Which is funny, because Cardinal Wolsey once said that if she had been born a man, she would have made history. In truth, she already had. To research this episode, journalist Amy Wilson read Catherine of Aragon by Garrett Mattingly and consulted a whole sheaf of websites that broke down Catherine's timeline as well as the timeline of her two husbands. She watched a few miniseries, lived through an array of actresses imitating Catherine's iron will, and her daughter made her listen to the soundtrack of Six. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.